All right, so this is the seventh fundamental teachings class. And tonight we're talking about Buddha nature. So, of all of the topics that we will have discussed, including emptiness and suchness, I would say this is the most difficult to grasp. But, like, I mean, at least empty to be like, okay, I get it. Yeah, like, nothing's, you know, nothing's really, you know, what it seems. And then suchness, and like, we all have glimpses of like how everything's kind of complete and precious. Okay. And then Buddha nature is like, so, do not expect to leave this class with a sense that you get it. Which is like, well, why do we talk about it then? I think this is a prime example of how Zen teachings are not about you acquiring more ideas and concepts, but about challenging the ideas you already have. So we engage with these teachings, even though we don't necessarily get any immediate satisfaction, but it's kind of working on us, right? It's challenging the ways that we look at things and ourselves. So I thought I would start off with a beautiful short verse about Buddha nature by Huang Po. So I can pass those out, and I will both share the link to this Google document in the chat, and then I will briefly share screen. So if you want, let me know if for some reason you can't, people try to pull that up and you can't do it. So once I'm done sharing screen, you can have it up if you like. And I will read it out loud. This is by Huang Po, a 9th century Chinese Chan master. Our original Buddha nature is, in highest truth, devoid of any atom of objectivity. It is void, omnipresent, silent, pure. It is glorious and mysterious, peaceful joy, and that is all. Enter deeply into it by awaking to it yourself. That which is before you is it, in all its fullness, utterly complete. There is not beside. Even if you go through all the stages of a bodhisattva's progress toward Buddhahood one by one, when at last in a single flash you attain to full realization, you will only be realizing the Buddha nature which has been with you all the time. And by all the foregoing stages, you will have added to it nothing at all. You will come to look upon those eons of work and achievement as no better than unreal actions performed in a dream. It is pure mind which is the source of everything, and which, whether appearing as sentient beings or as Buddhas, as the rivers and mountains of the world which has form, as that which is formless, or as penetrating the whole universe, it is absolutely without distinctions, there being no such entities as selfness and otherness. So I am not going to just sit and explain all of that. Although, let's see, I thought I had. Our original Buddha nature is in truth devoid of any atom of objectivity. And objectivity meaning intentness on objects external to the mind, or external reality. So if our Buddha nature is in truth devoid of any atom of objectivity, there's nothing like outside of us that we, oh, there it is. So I'm gonna leave that to stew for a while. So to put Buddha nature in the context of the teachings that we have been studying, so we started with studying the self, or using the self or our own direct experience as the laboratory for awakening to the truth of impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha, or dissatisfactoriness. And I realized my dissatisfaction with those classes, the way that I taught them this year, and I was like, that didn't seem much like Zen. And I realized it's because the way that they are often phrased in original Buddhism is kind of like, it's tempting for me anyway to think of them as like their principles that are out there. Like everything is imperfect, everything is insubstantial, like it's a physical law or something. Where in Zen we're not, you know, pondering and observing like that. We are looking within our own direct experience, particularly of self, of the impermanence of all things that we identify as self, or being part of self, or as being ours, or the insubstantial nature of those things. And the dukkha, the dissatisfactoriness that's caused when we want to grasp those things. So this is when Dogen says to become familiar, or we say to study the Buddha way is to study the self, but Shohaku Okamura in his book on Genjo Koan explains that this the word that's translated as to study is really to learn, to become familiar with. So it's almost better to say to become familiar with the Buddha way is to become familiar with the self. And then to become familiar with the self is to forget the self. So we study the self and we get to realize, geez, you know, I'm not what I think I am. Like, what is the deal? And that leads us to a perception of emptiness. That's to study the self is to forget the self. Emptiness, which leads to freedom from fear. And then, having recognized that this mental map we have used to navigate reality is just a map, and we, at times, we can actually recognize it as a map, or we can see through it and see without it, that is when we perceive suchness or thusness, the completeness and preciousness of things as it is. Then we talked about the two truths, which is an aspect of reality where in our experience it feels like reality has two aspects. It has this kind of perfection and completeness that we might glimpse at certain moments, and then there's daily life, right? Then there's, like, you know, the absolute, it's often called absolute or relative. I call it dependent and independent dimensions. Dependent is the dimension of time and space and causality and good and bad and discrimination and all of that, right? The way we have to navigate in the world. But then there is also the independent dimension, which has no dimension. It's just this here now. It's reality right here now. Like, you can never grasp it, right? You say now, then it's past, right? It's seamless, it's boundless, it is without, it is independent of all of the ways that we discriminate it into parts. And it seems for a while in our practice like there are these two truths are very separate. But over time in practice, we try to come to see how they are, like we say, like they're two steps in walking, two sides of a coin. So sometimes we can end up perceiving that, like, and the absolute or this spiritual realm or whatever, everything is fine, and then everything sucks over here, and it's too bad we have to be stuck over here instead of being able to, you know, wander around in bliss. But it's like, that's not, they're not separate things. They're always right here. So when we get to Buddha nature, and I've talked about all of these things as describing reality with a capital R. They're different aspects. They're not separate things, really. They're just different aspects of one reality. Like if you were, you know, trying to portray a sunset, maybe you take a photograph of it, maybe you paint it, maybe you write a poem about it. Any portrayal is going to be focusing on different, you'd have to focus on some aspect of the sunset and convey it, because you can't convey the whole experience. So these teachings about reality are similar. They're pointing us to something that's important about the nature of reality. So for Buddha nature, you can imagine, I don't know, as a practitioner, that you know, you practiced really hard, you meditated, Dharma study, whatever, and you got some insight into emptiness or suchness, and you see the two truths and how, you know, maybe they're not really separate. And this can be an insight. These can be insights that you have, and maybe you take some solace in them. Maybe they provide you with some strength, but they're still you, right? You with your body and your karma and your desires and your feelings and your fears, and they can seem like very separate things, or like we're kind of stuck with or burdened by this individuality. But Buddha nature is the realization that this very being, this very individual manifestation that each of us has, is also such, also thus, so that completeness and preciousness that is true of everything else is also true of us. And we are boundaryless, not separate from all beings. So all things are the self. The self, instead of being like a small, sad, limited thing, is actually a very expansive, participatory thing. So the apparent paradox and delicious tension between being an individual at the same time as being actualized by the 10,000 things. So the next phrase of Dogen's, to become familiar with the Buddha way is to become familiar with the self. To become familiar with the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things, or actualized by all things. All things are like not separate from you, and I don't know, it's like joining a big family. So there's a redemptive quality to Buddha nature. It's like all of this obscure, potentially philosophical Dharma like comes home to us in a very personal way. But it takes, you might think like that all of this takes a lot of kind of intellectual or philosophical or spiritual like work, you know, to like get yourself into deep meditative states so that you can perceive these far out transcendent truths and that kind of thing. But to awaken to our Buddha nature, which is the most healing thing of all, requires us to actually do a lot of healing and work on self-acceptance to even get to that point. So rather than focusing out there, we're focused on like this little being, this little, just as you are in your flesh and bones, your life circumstances, your quirks, your karma, right there. Like, we have to make our, become familiar with, make our peace with, accept. One of the things that I think is the most telling sign of spiritual, I don't know, what do you want to say, like attainment, I think is just being able to see somebody who's really comfortable in their skin. If you just imagine, like, I mean, that just describes the Dalai Lama, doesn't it? It's just somebody who's just completely at home being who he is. So the Lotus Sutra is one of the sources we have for telling this story of awakening to our Buddha nature and what it really requires. So many of you are familiar with this story of the lost son, who, so this young man, he ends up leaving home, going out to seek his fortunes, and he does, you know, travels all over the place, and he gets into some really rough times, and, you know, he's really down and out. Eventually, he kind of ends up back home, but he doesn't recognize it as home. But his father recognizes him, and this is his only son and heir. And so he's so excited that his son has finally come back. But his son is so has been so changed that when the father comes up, he doesn't recognize him, and the father is like, and the son thinks he's going to like be arrested or thrown in jail or something like that, and the son is scared and runs away. So the father thinks, you know, what can he do? He doesn't want his son to leave again. So he sends somebody else out to hire the son to do like the most menial of tasks, you know, like mucking out the stables. So the son's kind of like, you know, cool, I got some good luck, you know. So he starts mucking out the stables, and then gradually, and the father's watching from afar, and gradually he promotes the son, and, you know, over the years, eventually the son moves into like, you know, kind of his right-hand helper. And finally the father feels like it's time, and he can say, this is actually, you know, my son, you are my heir. And the son is able to receive his inheritance. And that is like a 2,000-year-old story. So it means like this whole like low self-esteem thing is not like a new modern thing, right? This is like people have doubted themselves since time immemorial. We think that can't be me. There's, you know, not me. If you knew what was going on in here, you wouldn't think I could possibly be a Buddha. So, but it really, like, yeah, this process of self-acceptance and healing, you know, can be very long and gritty and messy and emotional and all that. It's like, you know, it's real human flesh and blood stuff. But at a certain point, when we recognize that we ourselves are also thus, you know, we recognize, like, we were always thus. Like, we didn't have to fix anything in order to become thus. It's like I don't know if this metaphor helps other folks, but sometimes I imagine, like, you know, if we're just kind of stuck, you know, we're seeing ourselves as the protagonist in this story, and like that, you know, things aren't going the way they should. But if you kind of step back and like recognize somehow, like, we're part of a beautiful novel, and it's all just part of the arc of development, right? This is all how it's supposed to happen. There's like, oh, okay, you know, I didn't realize I was playing a part in this bigger play. So, We are not who or what we think we are. So these are the personal implications of emptiness and suchness. So that may just be all quite overwhelming, but I could pause there if anybody wants to ask a question or contribute a comment.
Yomiel.
Yeah.
Thank you for the reading. You said 9th century monk at the beginning.
Yeah.
I love the concept of Buddha nature. Our education was influenced by the Puritans who gave us, you know, we had to earn to get better. And those words are in our culture for all of us, especially middle class. You know, we kind of buy into where we're not good yet. And to me, Buddha nature is about interbeing. And at the beginning of this century, there was an anthology with a lot of essays from people of various backgrounds. And Rachel Naomi Raymond from Commonweal in San Francisco said, let's not lose our quest, our sense of mystery, because we have that. We need that as human beings, you know, not to be so wise to lose that embrace. So just to know that we all have Buddha nature, children and everyone. You don't have to be a certain strata economically or nationally. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Ruthann. Eric.
Thank you. I want to be as succinct as possible, I promise. When I came to Oregon on my way to get here in time for Jukai, I came in on Saturday and I decided to drive all the way to Short Sands Beach to go ahead and drive all the way to the coast before I came and backtracked back to Beaverton. And I was driving through, I had just gotten into the coastal mountains, you know, where you really feel like you're in the mountains, you know. And I was listening to Alan Watts, he talked about, it was the chapter on Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. And it, so this has been like a reoccurring theme my entire 2 months that I've been in Oregon. And that's why I wanted to say something, because I felt there was a reason why this was coming up. Hmm. For me, this poem is just a beautiful summary of the Buddha nature. And I just I want to thank you all and you all and you all for, I don't even know, you may read this poem and be confused and be like, oh, this is over my head or esoteric, but you guys have shown me Buddha nature in every single way and every single day. Mm. And I'm just grateful. And the summary of what he says there, to me, the Buddha nature became that intent to want to be better, that desire, that drive that brings us here to for the benefit of all beings. And so to me, it was, with my Pentecostal Christian background, it was very easy to kind of comprehend that the Buddha nature is it is what we look for, but it's also why we look. Mm. So I just want to say that.
I can't say it any better. That's lovely. AJ.
Hi. So this kind of reminded me of an experience I had a while back, and I maybe didn't have words for it at the time. And I don't know that I do now either, but maybe I can try to get my point across a little bit. So a little while back, I was out at the beach, maybe a month ago, and I was just kind of sitting on the sand, zoning out, just watching the waves roll in, and, you know, I was noticing, like, there's some big waves that come in, and there's some smaller waves, and just kind of thinking about that, and like, oh, I don't notice any change in the wind or anything, like, why are some of these big, some small? And, you know, just kind of like thinking to myself, strangely, and then I realized that the waves are just water, right? Like, it's just water. Every wave is the same. It's just the ocean, and the waves can't exist without the water, but it's also the nature of the ocean to be in waves. And so, like, this reading today just kind of made me think of that, like, even though there's all these individual waves, they're all just the ocean, and they can't exist outside of the ocean. And so maybe that's something that's, I don't know, maybe that's a glimpse of, like, what we're talking about. I don't know. But for me, like, I don't know, it seemed pretty profound at the time, and just kind of kept that in the back of my mind. So, thank you.
Yeah, that's a very, that comparison is often made. You know, the similarly, like, the individuality in your, it is a thing, it's a temporary thing, but it's also part of something larger. And I don't know, you can almost, you may or may not, but some of us having a glimpse of, like, completeness, oneness, if you will, it seems kind of like, kind of sad, kind of a shame to, like, then recede back into your individuality, which can seem so kind of limiting and isolating and all that. I mean, we're very attached to that individuality as well, and yet it's kind of a love-hate thing, you know? It's what keeps us feeling separate. And yet, like, that is, like, kind of like you're saying, that's nature of water to have waves. And I feel like the way that we say that in Buddhism is without sentient beings there are no Buddhas. I mean, that there's no one to awaken to being one if there's not an individual, you know. So it's this kind of beautiful tension. Leah.
Okay, can you guys hear me? Oh, good. Okay. So I tend to be really intellectual about this, at, like, everything. I tend to be over intellectual about everything. And so I kind of do this cop out where with Buddha nature, I just think, well, it must just be the ground upon which everything rests and that everything is made of. Okay, I can imagine that. And then I sort of go, okay, that's it. But that doesn't really, I mean, I'm just, like, imagining that everything's made out of, I don't know, water, like you were saying, like, everything's made out of water, and so Buddha nature is just water, or, like, physics, you know. Then I'll go, okay, well, you know, everything is basically four kinds of quarks, you know, whatever. That kind of thing. So I kind of reduce it oddly to some sort of intellectual stuff. And I don't think that, I have the feeling I'm going down the wrong track, but I'm just saying it and sharing it in case anyone else is on, well, that track sometimes with it.
Just set me up perfectly for the next section of the discussion, what Buddha nature is not, right? Because we really spend more time talking in a way, some ways, about what it's not than what it is, because you get, it's so, you know, how do you capture what it is? So this is a passage from Yasutani Roshi, 20th century Japanese Zen master, and he's talking about the problem of conceptualizing Buddha nature, which essentially all of us all of us are going to do. All of us have, I mean, that's just the way that our minds work. So he says, now some of you, thinking there is something called the Buddha nature hidden within us, may inquire as to the whereabouts of this Buddha nature. You may tend to equate it with conscience, which everyone, even the wicked, is presumed to possess. You will never understand the truth of Buddha nature so long as you harbor such a specious view. This world, unfixed, devoid of mass, beyond individuality or personality, is outside the realm of imagination. Accordingly, the true substance of things, that is their Buddha or Dharma nature, is inconceivable and inscrutable. Since everything imaginable partakes of form or color, whatever one imagines to be Buddha nature must of necessity be unreal. Indeed, that which can be conceived is but a picture of Buddha nature, not Buddha nature itself. But while Buddha nature is beyond all conception and imagination, because we ourselves are intrinsically Buddha nature, it is possible for us to awaken to it. So, Buddha nature is a quality of being, not a thing, and is therefore devoid of mass. It is not a quality, thus does not partake of color or form. So, I thought it might be, I thought I might do a little guided meditation. Just be a few minutes. But, like, this is, I don't know. It may not work for you at all, but it may give you just a little sensation of Buddha nature. So, imagine you are with someone you admire and trust completely, absolutely. Someone who knows you intimately and loves you unconditionally. So you may know someone like this. I certainly, both of my parents, I have the great blessing that they qualify. But I'll pick my mom, who just, I can do no wrong in her eyes. So try to, if you don't necessarily have a real person, try to imagine what your mom should have been like. Just loving and kind and attentive, but also wise. And now imagine you are in this person's embrace. You are feeling kind of dejected or stressed or overwhelmed, and they just have their arm around you. And they tell you, you are okay. You are fine. I love you. You are lovable. You are beautiful. There's nothing wrong. You are okay. And imagine if you were able to really, really relax and believe that. not come up with excuses as to why that is not the case. You just trust this person enough. You know they're not just lying to you. They're not just trying to make you feel better. This is really how they see you. So that sense of ease and coming home and relaxation, that is something akin to realizing your own Buddha nature. So, why is it called Buddha nature? Buddha is an awakened being. He's awakened to reality, is liberated from fear and self-interest. So what, I mean, you could call this our suchness nature, right? So like, well, you know, what does it have to do with Buddhahood? I think Buddha nature, because at times in the history of Buddhism, Buddha nature has really been discussed as the potential for awakening in each of us. Sometimes it's even called like the Buddha womb, or the Buddha seed. And then there's an aspect of truth to that. In Zen, we tend to go beyond that, right? And like Dogen says, all things are Buddha nature. All things, like Huang Po is going in that direction, right? But there is an aspect of it which is very closely tied, as Eric said, to our seeking. Like, in a way, we wouldn't even think to seek if there wasn't something in us that already knows. So we are it, and as long as we are it, it will keep presenting itself to us until we finally wake up. But there is a lot of emphasis in the teachings on the necessity of practice. That the merit of this teaching, the strength of it, the medicine of this teaching doesn't come from. I mean, it's nice to have a little faith in it, right? It's nice to hear and kind of change your mindset. But that is not doesn't truly give you the strength, right? It doesn't truly give you the freedom from fear. It doesn't truly heal. You know, that's kind of like, I don't know, somebody saying, you know, there's a heaven after death and everything will be fine then. So, like, you just kind of trust that, you know, there's solace somewhere. But we can taste this truth for ourselves. So the fact that you have Buddha nature, but you don't feel like you do, is likened to another Lotus Sutra story where a guy goes to visit his friend before setting off on a long journey, and the friend, while his guest isn't looking, he sews a valuable jewel into his cloak. The friend goes off and does his travels and ends up falling into hard times and struggling. And when he finally gets back to his friend says, but you had this jewel in your cloak the whole time, right? Well, It didn't do you any good if you didn't know it was there or didn't know how to use it, right? So it's like this treasure that we have, but that if we don't know how to access it, then it's not that much help to us. So, any comments or questions? How I mean, nobody has to answer, but I do find myself sometimes wondering, like, how people relate to this teaching. Yeah. This is Kyle.
I think with Buddha nature, like you were saying, it's a very mysterious thing. There's a lot to potentially intellectualize if you want to. Sort of the kind of thing you could ponder as long as you want and still not really come to it that way. But the way that I think of it is just in the word nature. I don't know about anybody here, but I tend to be a bit pessimistic about the nature of people and about the nature of reality, and think basically, seeing how I am and seeing how other people are, people must have the nature towards madness, or maybe not badness, but it's the opposite of enlightenment, and darkenment, maybe. And Buddha nature, the idea of it is, you can ponder it as much as you want, but what I think it is a reassurance that that isn't all that there is to people, that Buddha nature is also intrinsic, and you don't have to be afraid that it's inevitable to fall into mental darkness or not find the truth because you have Buddha nature. You do have the nature that you can find that. And I don't know. It's hard to trust that sometimes when you're just looking at the outside world. So it feels nice to have that reassurance, I guess.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you put that well when it's kind of like, yeah, any way you can think about it is just a way to think about it. But sometimes it helps us just carry the teaching along with us, and I don't know, sometimes I think of it as like I would say like the power of the truth. I mean, it might sound a little like specious, right? Like thinking, oh, everybody has a conscience and knows what's really right and all that. But it's like when you act in accord with the truth, things work in a particular way. And when you act not in accord with the truth, there's suffering and conflict and sadness. And like, so it's kind of like, I don't know, it's almost like gravity, right? Like it's just like the force of the truth that we will be pulled toward the truth eventually. Bob.
Thanks, Donio. This has always bothered me, but Buddha nature, if Buddha is the awakened, so is Buddha nature the constellation of things that comprise the awakened awareness of a consciousness, and how does that relate to the concept of self, as we have the idea of self-consciousness, that we are conscious of our physical and emotional being. So in other words, is the Buddha nature including the self, or does the self include the Buddha nature?
Buddha nature definitely includes the self. And I think, I don't know if this is relevant to what you're asking, but I think to get us out of certain ways of thinking about Buddha nature, I think this is why the ancestors often said, like, rocks and trees are also Buddha nature. When you're kind of like, well, wait a second. I thought, you know, this is about, like, my potential to awaken, you know, so that's, you know, has to be a sentient being, conscious sentient being who can awaken to something, right? So that kind of belies, like, no, you know, that's not what we're talking about. So almost like Buddha nature in a sentient being might lead us to a Zen center and lead us to awakening, and like Buddha nature in a rock might manifest differently, but it is it really goes back to that, you know, when we perceive suchness or thusness, when we perceive things without our mental map, just as they are, like each thing, never a really good thing for me to pick up here, but I mean, each thing is just, damn. Like, it's just, it's like it's speaking. It's like it has its own being. It's its own place within this big piece in the universe, and it is complete and individual. Like, it's the beauty of the individual within the whole. So you can look at just anything, right? You can look at your mug of tea and just be like, oh, I mean, there it is. You can look at, like, a pile of dog poop on the sidewalk, just similarly, like, there it is. Natalie.
I know I brought this concept up before. I don't know if it was last year at the same talk about the holographic universe, if anyone remembers me talking about that, but that helps me so much, that the concept of a hologram, it's almost like you're seeing the different aspects, like we're talking about the sunset or like the hand with the different fingers, but in a hologram, all the information is there, but you're seeing a certain image. There's a whole book on that called The Holographic Universe, which is one of my favorite books, so... which, Leah, you might like, because it discusses quantum mechanics and physics and starts off with that, and then it goes into all of these kind of phenomenal things that happened that, you can take it from very scientific to these mysterious things that happen in the world and the universe. And then the other is there's a Taoist saying of first there was the one, and then the two, and then the 10,000 things. Which, I don't know, just that concept, there's the oneness. It can split into two, but you still have the everything in each of those. And then it branches out. And so to me, it makes sense that the Buddha nature would be in anything, like a inanimate object or an animate object, if it's all coming from that same source, and that same source is retained in everything. And so I don't know if that's answering the question of what is Buddha nature. I'm trying to but that everythingness is within everything, and the awareness of that, I guess, is what we're getting to, of the, even though it's not a thing, I know, it's hard to describe it. I'm trying to
well,
put
I
it
think,
into words.
I think you're, the imagery that you're describing, it actually reminds me of stuff that is done in the Avatamsaka Sutra, where it's just like, it just describes for like pages and pages and pages and pages, be like, and then this Buddha, he manifested a crown on his head, and in every jewel there were 1,000 Buddhas, and every one of them had a crown, and they had jewels, and in every jewel there was like another universe, and like it just goes on and on and on, and you're like, but you can kind of feel your brain stretching.
Yeah.
You can just, it just, it's kind of reminding us of like how limited our view ordinarily is, and like how much more. I mean, if we could just look for a moment through our dog's eyes, it would be just like, oh my God, like, or smell through our dog's nose, however that
would be. Right. Well, that, someone was saying something about, you know, kids versus having the Buddha nature, small children versus, you know, doesn't matter what age. And I think when babies are born, it's really probably very much, yeah, very much there. And then there's like an unknowing that happens because they're told to not, I don't know, that's one of my thoughts, is that it's maybe more present when you first incarnate. And then when you're leaving your body too, a lot of times people have that awakening. So the coming into the physical and leaving that physical, it seems like are times when maybe there's a greater chance for it. Anyway, just a lot of rambling about this.
All right, well, we have reached our 9 o'clock, so we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom is beyond wisdom, Maha Parashana Paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Tony.